Warning: the following podcast, which contains strong language and mature content, is unsuitable for children or for the faint of heart. The subject matter discussed will be frightening and graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
When you want to hear about the paranormal, you get the Spooked Girls. True crime that makes you hypothermal with the three Spooked Girls. Stabby snippets will give you dreams. Tara and Jessica will make you. Along with the Spooked Girls. Bring on the slaughter. We on that haunted ground. Spooked Girls. The three Spooked Girls.
Hey, Spooksters, and welcome back to another episode here on Three Spooked Girls. My name is Tara, and as always, I'm here with my girlfriend, Jessica.
Hello.
Hello. Oh my God. It's been a minute since we've recorded a, just an audio only episode.
I know.
And I feel so fucking weird right now.
I know. I'm like, I can do whatever I want right now.
I can look like a potato and just sit here. Yay.
I look like a potato because I'm doing like oil. I'm oiling my hair right now. So multitasking.
Self-care. All right. Well, as you guys can see by the title, we're going to do another roundup of true crime headlines. I'm just going to get right into it. Okay. So these first two are big cases, ones that we've covered and people have asked for updates. So I have a Koberger alibi for you guys that was filed recently.
Wow, wow.
I have an article that gives us the takeaways for Chad Daybell's trial happening right now.
Ooh.
Yes, we're a week in. And then I have some articles of cases in the news. So we are just going to get into it. Okay, so shout out People Magazine, because I always see like all their true crime stuff on Instagram. So I just like bookmark stuff that I'm like, ooh, you guys want to hear about this. So
and I also send you so much from People Magazine.
Oh my God, yeah. Pretty much most of my articles are from there. It's fine. So how strong is Idaho murder suspect Brian Koberger's alibi? Legal expert weighs in exclusive. So before I read that, though, I did take screenshots of the document from his lawyer listing what his alibi is. And let me find that crock of shit. One second.
And I have literally not like looked into this because I had a feeling this was going to be on a headline soon with you. So I was like, ooh, but like just our mods group chat, they were talking about it. I was like, no, don't look.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Mr. Koberger moved to Pullman, Washington in June of 2022. As an avid runner and hiker, he explored many areas of Palouse. I'm probably saying that wrong. I'm sorry. Of note, he explored Wawaway Park in July of 2022, and this became his favorite location. After the school year began, Mr. Koberger was busy with classes and working at Washington State University, and his running and hiking decreased but did not stop. Instead, his nighttime drives increased. This is supported by data from Mr. Koberger's phone showing him in the countryside late at night and or in the early morning on several occasions. The phone data includes numerous photographs taken on several different late evenings and early mornings, including in November, depicting the night sky. Mr. Koberger was out driving in the early morning hours of November 13th, 2022, as he often did to hike and run and or see the moon and stars. He drove through the area south of Pullman, Washington, west of Moscow, Idaho, including Wawaway Park. Mr. Koberger intends to offer testimony of Cy Ray, CSLI expert, which is cell phone tower, cell phone, and other radio frequency curricula vitae is attached to show that Brian Koberger's mobile device was south of Pullman, Washington, and west of Moscow, Idaho on November 13, 2022. That put Brian's mobile device did not travel east on the Moscow-Pullman highway in the early morning hours of November 13th, and thus could not be the vehicle captured on video along the Moscow-Pullman highway near Floyd's cannabis shop. Additional information as to Mr. Koberger's whereabouts as the early morning hours progressed include additional analysis by Mr. Mr. Ray, who will be provided once the state provides discovery requested and now subject to an upcoming motion to compel. If not disclosed, Mr. Ray's testimony will also reveal that critical evidence furthermore corroborating Mr. Koberger's alibi was either not preserved or has been withheld. And that was, so we're recording this on 420 and this was filed on the 17th. So this was just filed a couple days ago. Now I can't wait to read this article to you because now we have some other legal people weighing in. Also, let's just mention that the cell phone data showed that his fucking phone was off. Just saying.
Right. That was going to be my part. It's like we knew that from a long time ago that his cell phone was turned off. Mm-hmm. So his alibi is that before his phone was turned off, he was slightly near the area, but not in the area.
He was looking at the stars. He was looking at the stars is what he's saying. By himself. How can you have an alibi by yourself?
Yeah, no, you get an alibi from another person. Another person has to like swear that you were with them the entire time and have a story that corroborates it. Mm-hmm. If you do not have that, you don't have a fucking alibi. You have potential evidence to show that you weren't. It's not an alibi.
Exactly.
I think he's grasping at every straw he can somehow find.
Oh, for sure. And the distance that they're even saying too is only 8 miles away, so that's not very far.
So when you think about it, like people going 60 miles an hour, it's 8 minutes away. So we're talking about like, let's say maybe 15-20 minute difference. Okay.
Oh, you went there after or before? Cool. So there's a former federal prosecutor, Nayama Ramani, and she says it's a weak alibi defense, but Koberger's team needs to come up with some argument to get around the cell phone evidence. And then she says, the reason this is coming out now is most states require the defense to provide notice of an alibi defense. So it's required by law. If you don't provide the advance notice, you can't raise the defense at trial. So what I think is happening is that Koberger's defense team, they're trying to tailor the story to the evidence. I mean, who drives themselves in the middle of the night for no reason to look at the stars? That's a great point. Like we've talked about before, according to the affidavit, his phone pinged 12 times in that area of the home of where those college kids were murdered prior to the 13th. The affidavit also said, like, all of these occasions, except for one, occurred in the late evening and early morning hours of their respective days. So same fucking time frame.
Straws grasping at.
Literally, because the former attorney goes on to say that, you know, the cell phone and the DNA evidence on the knife are the two most damaging pieces of evidence. They can't fucking, what are they going to say about his DNA? What are they going to say about that? They can't really say anything. So that's why they're trying to grasp at this thing. That's obviously not going to work. So that's what's going on with that. He's still on his fucking bullshit. Because if you're not following that case, he was a PhD student at Washington State University with his degrees in criminology. So piece of shit.
Piece of shit.
Yeah, I'll keep you guys updated on that. All right, so moving to the next piece of shit. Here is our article from abc4.com for Chad Daybell's trial. The first full week of Chad Daybell's murder trial came to an end Friday afternoon, but the trial will resume next week, which means when you're hearing this, the week you're hearing this. Chad is being tried for the murders of Tylee Ryan and Joshua J.J. Vallow, the two children of Lori Vallow, his wife who was sentenced to life in prison in 2023. Daybell is also on trial for the murder of his former wife, Tammy. So here are their takeaways for this past week. So one of Lori's close friends, Melanie Gibb, testified on the stand. Gibb said Chad labeled people as dark, and people with that label were later referenced to as zombies, which you guys might remember when we went over court documents a couple years ago. Gibb said Daybell was the only one who could tell if someone was a zombie. According to Gibb, Daybell told those close to him that Tammy, JJ, and Tylee were all zombies shortly before they died or disappeared. Gibb said Chad and Lori believed that after performing rituals to cast out dark spirits, a person's body would die naturally if another spirit didn't take its place. Furthermore, a former FBI agent testified about text messages exchanged between Chad and Lori. The two were exchanging messages about their marriages in the past lives and how they would be together again, even while Tammy was still alive. The agent said neither Chad nor Lori showed signs of sorrow after the death of Lori's husband, Charles. Instead, they were more upset that his $1 million life insurance policy went to his sister. Then on Tuesday, prosecutors questioned FBI tactical specialist Nicole Heidman, who was tasked with reviewing web searches on accounts belonging to both Chad and Lori. Information revealed that he reportedly searched for things like malachite and bodies possessed after original occupant dies. Heidman said possession was a common thread through the investigation, with some of the names being searched being aliases of Chad Lorre and victims associated with the case. Daybell also reportedly searched for wind direction the day before he allegedly burned and buried the body of Tylee Ryan. Vallow's search history reportedly showed inquiries regarding child life insurance and wedding dresses in Hawaii, amongst other topics. Disgusting. And so Melanie, again, she said that Chad and Lorre met at a conference in Southern Utah in 2018. She knew both Chad and Lorre were married to other people at the time that they met, but they said that they seemed to be attracted to each other. Well, doesn't make it right, you pieces of shit. She goes on to say she was told by Lorre that she and Chad were planning to be, quote, resealed like they had been in previous lives together, and that Lorre often turned to Chad for advice. Through Chad, Gibbs said that Lorre learned more about spiritual possession and, quote, castings to remove evil spirits. Gibbs said she became suspicious after the disappearance of JJ and confronted Lorre about it, especially after police were told that JJ was with her. Because remember, they showed, she's like, oh, they stayed there. And so they went over there, and this bitch is like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
You have to make sure your alibi like will lie for you. You can't have an alibi that's like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Literally. And she also said she was told that Tammy, Chad's former wife, was becoming suspicious of Lorre and Chad. But before Tammy died, Lorre said Tammy was supposed to continue her mission on the other side of the veil, meaning after she died. That's her basically being like, yeah, she's gonna die. Then in November 2019, just days after the death of Chad's previous wife, Chad and Lorre flew to Hawaii to get married. And court exhibits show Chad sent a letter to a realtor about a property. And in the letter, he said him and Lorre had no pets or children. At the time the email was sent, prosecutors highlighted the fact that investigators were still searching for Tylee and JJ. Within days of Tylee's death, records show Lorre emptied her daughter's account and had previously moved Tylee's social security deposits to her own. Travel records also showed that Lorre traveled to Missouri with her niece and Lorre used Tylee's phone, despite there being no record of Tylee traveling with them. Lorre was also receiving social security benefits for her and JJ after the death of Charles. And a forensic accountant with the FBI testified that Daybell sent money to his children when investigators searched his property for the first time and when the investigation into the missing children was announced. On the day the bodies of Tylee and JJ were found, Daybell reportedly sent a total of, oh my God, I forgot about this, $26,000 to his children.
Damn, that's a lot.
In the LDS church, a patriarchal blessing is said to contain personal counsel from the Lord. This type of blessing is given by a church leader with a specific title and status, a title and status that Chad did not have. However, he gave a blessing to Lori's brother, Alex Cox, who's also dead now, and a recording of it was presented as an exhibit. And in the recording, he said, I want to begin by opening up the portals of time and go back to your previous creations in which you lived. The blessing was administered about a month before Cox died.
So basically, like, Chad Daybell would give you a blessing and then you would die.
Yep.
Angel of death to you.
Yep. That's where we're at with him. I'm not really too concerned about if he's going to be found guilty. We all know he is. The sentencing portion will be what to watch, I think. Just kind of will be interesting. So moving on to our other headlines for this episode. So this next one reads, man allegedly killed 15-year-old daughter, then tried to blame stepson with autism.
No, that's so bad on so many levels.
Mm-hmm. Police in Ohio have accused a 38-year-old man of fatally shooting his 15-year-old daughter, then trying to blame his son with autism. Kenneth Paul Farler III is facing one count each of involuntary manslaughter, reckless homicide, and child endangering along with gun charges in connection to the death of Kendra Farler. Police said the April 16th shooting occurred at a boarding house in the 400 block of Bowen Street where Farler was living. Officers arrived at the scene after receiving a 911 call after 12 p.m. Sunday, April 14th. The remarks on the call stated that a female of 15 years of age was shot and killed at the residence and that she was killed by her 15-year-old sibling, who is autistic and nonverbal, the Dayton Police Department Major Brian Johns said at the press conference on Tuesday. Johns said that officers spoke with Farler and the teen's stepmom and both stated she was shot and killed by the sibling. Those statements later proved to be false and that the young lady was shot and killed by her father inside the residence. We have great investigators here at the Dayton Police Department and they knew right away that all those stories weren't consistent and upon further questioning got an admission to the crime. John said he didn't believe the shooting was an accident. Even our victim was asking him not to point a shotgun at her prior to her death, so that's not an accident. and the stepmother has been charged and is cooperating in the investigation. John said, "I was there with the entire homicide squad Sunday, and to say it was a tragedy is an understatement." And it's unclear if Farler has retained an attorney to speak on his behalf. But yeah, like, he literally, when he called 911, he was like, "It was an accident. He didn't know what he was doing. He's autistic." Like, he's saying all that, like, he's fucking trying to cover his ass.
And that's so terrible, because they're are a lot of people who railroad nonverbal because they think they don't understand the disorder, and then it's vile. And the fact that this kid couldn't, one, that you would, as an adult, would blame your crime on a child, but two, blame it on a child who can't defend themselves.
It's vile.
And I say this, when I say become violent, I do not mean like try to like kill someone. I do mean like some nonverbal autistic people like can't be touched, and then they'll start hitting when they do. If you are untrained, like if you're an untrained police officer, you might not know those signs. And actually kind of glad, because this is like a thing in California right now. They're trying to pass a law to like basically make it mandatory to learn skills to deal with nonverbal autistic. And it's a skill they should learn, and they should get, and the reason they need to have a law for this is so they can get funding for it.
Good. Everywhere should do that. All right. Our next one reads, "Mom pushes for answers after daughter vanished from boyfriend's yacht 3 years ago. Sarm Heslop disappeared on a foreign island in 2021. Her boyfriend's alleged actions in the aftermath only deepen her family's fear of foul play." Never heard of this, and this is so recent. "It was March of 2022, and Brenda Street was getting increasingly frustrated during her trip to the U.S. Virgin Islands to find out what happened to her daughter, Sarm Heslop, who had been missing for a year. Heslop, a 41-year-old flight attendant from England, was last seen in March of 2021, within weeks of arriving in St. John's in the U.S. Virgin Islands with her new boyfriend, Ryan Bain, who operated high-end cruises on his yacht, the Siren Song. The two had met on Tinder in June of 2020 in Grenada, and after Heslop briefly left for Malta in the fall, Bain asked if she would return to be with him. I think she was starting to fall in love with him for sure. She loved to send photos of their adventures together," her best friend said. "I think she was excited as to see what the future is going to hold. They're almost in paradise, aren't they?" But things took a turn when Street received a call in the UK from Bain on March 8th, 2021, claiming that Heslop disappeared from his catamaran in the middle of the night and she had not been seen since. What started off as an adventure in paradise for Heslop has now become a three-year-long agonizing mystery for her family and friends. Soon after her disappearance, they began suspecting foul play. Their concerns only deepened when they heard Bain allegedly refused to let local authorities into his yacht during their search for her, according to a Coast Guard report reviewed by People. Bain's lawyer, David Caddy, says allegations that he did not let authorities in the yacht are categorically false. Like, okay, why would they make that up? David Johnston, a private investigator working pro bono for Heslop's family, claims he has heard through his sources on the ground that Bain has since made several changes to his yacht, including allegedly refitting the freezer, fueling Johnston and Heslop's family's suspicion that Bain may have had a role in her disappearance. Bain has never been charged in connection with the case. While Street feels Bain has some questions to answer, she also maintains that the island police have failed to conduct a thorough investigation, including interviewing him. They've not done their job as police officers, and they certainly haven't done their job as human beings. A series of suspicious activities on the island following her disappearance has only added to Street's concerns. Following her disappearance, locals on the island had put up missing posters around the island. One day, Street claims to have received a photo showing someone had scribbled out the name of Bain's yacht from a poster. During her visit, Street had a strange interaction with a local shop owner, she says. The shop owner was eagerly chatting with Street until she learned why she was visiting. Whereas the lady had been really friendly, it was like she clammed up and wouldn't say anything. Authorities in St. John told People an investigation is ongoing but did not provide further information. Street wasn't always suspicious of Bain. During the initial stage of the investigation, she gave him benefit of the doubt, she says. That changed, she learned, after she learned more about him. Soon after Heslop's disappearance, she tried to contact Bain but claims her messages didn't go through, which made her suspect he had blocked her. Caddy said he's unaware of Bain blocking any numbers. Eye roll. After Heslop's story got out, Bain's ex-wife, Corey Stevenson, came forward alleging abuse during their marriage and that she had left because she was fearing for her life. He was convicted in that domestic battery case and sentenced to 31 days. Stevenson immediately called the U.S. Virgin Island police to tell them they should investigate Bain, but she contends the police didn't take her seriously. While Heslop's friends and family continue their search, they do worry they may not find her alive. Her mom and dad have reluctantly come to the conclusion that Sarm is probably dead and was murdered by somebody, Johnston says. So a significant change really from find Sarm to justice for Sarm. While they searched for justice, Heslop's friends and family continue with activities that honor her memory. Her parents dedicated a bench in her name at a waterfront near where Heslop lived in Southampton. Her friends gather for her birthday or on the anniversary of her disappearance to share stories and her favorite food. Vernal said if she hadn't gone missing, Heslop would probably continue her journey into the next adventure. She just would have done anything to continue traveling, and she was fine with that. It didn't put any fear in her to go to new places. That is so fucking sad. Well, we have one more, and it's kind of a little bit more of a not happier one because it's still very dark, but it's someone was found. So pregnant woman rescued days ago was abducted 10 years ago as a schoolgirl. And this came out in the 18th. So this is super recent too. The Nigerian army announced the rescue of Lydia Simon, who says she was one of 276 girls kidnapped from their school in Chibok in 2014. And I apologize if I'm saying that wrong. The army made the announcement about Lydia Simon's dramatic rescue in a social media post on Thursday. The post included a photo of Simon and her children, who the army says was rescued by Nigerian troops in the area of Gwaza in Borno State. The army said in its announcement that its troops acted on intelligence intercepted from the alleged extremists who were holding Simon. The extremists were armed with assault-style rifles and other dangerous weapons, according to the Nigerian army. The Nigerian troops laid wait for their suspects, and they engaged in a gun battle, killing three of Simon's captors while rescuing her and her children. Simon was one of 276 girls who were kidnapped from their school in Chibok in April of 2014. The Associated Press reports that about 82 of the girls who were kidnapped are still being held by extremists. Lydia was 5 months pregnant at the time of her rescue. The 2014 kidnapping was one of the first in a series of mass school kidnappings in the region. The incident shocked the world and led to the Bring Our Girls Back campaign on social media, which called for the safe return of nearly 300 schoolgirls. Simon's rescue comes days after the 10-year anniversary of the kidnapping. The AP recently reported that despite the high-profile kidnappings in the region over the last decade, schools in the country still have many security flaws. Only about 43% of minimum safety standards are shown to have been met in more than 6,000 schools that were surveyed by the United Nations Children's Agency and their Nigeria office.
It's so sad. I'm glad she's free, but it's so sad that it's been 10 years since these girls have been taken.
Right? I can't even imagine what they have been through. Like, that's so awful. But I'm so glad that, you know, she's alive and her kids are alive and they rescued them out of there. So heartbreaking. All right. Well, that is going to go ahead and wrap us up for today. We hope you guys enjoyed the updates. If you guys have any cases that you see in headlines or update on cases we've covered before and you want me to cover them, just let us know in the Facebook group or on socials. But with that, we're going to go ahead and sign off and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Toodles.